got right to this, somebody picks the pen up and whatever thoughts come in, put it down. That's, you know, for your exams, I suppose. But when you have to communicate the truth, how many times you have to review that you got it right? If you got the principle right, you know, the truth right, and I think that would take a whole lot of, it's a new level altogether. And I would say that I've done some dramas in the past and I've written them, and I have account of what happened. And then you get poetic license where to make it good for the listener. You know, you can put a few things in there which are good, you know, modern stuff, so people can relate to it and get the point. But in something like Bhagavatam and all that, you cannot do that. Because, you know, from years after you're written and gone, people will then criticize, maybe invalidate what you've written because of one or two things you put which are not accurate. People will pick on it. So I would say the job of translating Bhagavad Gita and Bhagavatam would be really, really immense. And Harisari Prabhu very nicely explained that his conversation with Srila Prabhupada in a room where he wanted to know the divine touch, you know, which he, Srila Prabhupada received, to say, it's okay, you're right, and we're behind you, the superiors, as in this term, very nice term, superiors. And it's almost like a James Bond movie, you know, I can't do this because my superiors say so, you know. So he had superiors. So, and who the superiors were, it was amazing what they were. And, you know, we shouldn't be surprised, but we are happy that that divine connection of parampara, you know, was there and up to date, like now, you know, in our times. And they bypass all of the gurus, come directly to the one who's serving in parampara, tell him, don't worry, we're assuring you. And then also Guru Prabhupada, his own Guru Maharaj was coming and assuring him, you know, and he wasn't even on the planet. And I think this is fantastic for me. Lovely presentation. So for yesterday, at least, give him a big round of applause. And today, there's more to come. So be all ears. Thank you.
Okay, so we finished up last night. I mentioned about this personality, Gopal Chandra Ghosh, and how he had met Srila Prabhupada when he was at the Radha Damodar. And Prabhupada had told him about this visitation that he'd had from Srila Rupa Jiva and Sanatan Goswamis whilst he was just at the beginning, I think, of writing the Bhagavatam. And there was actually another time when Prabhupada did mention several times that his writing was coming from Krishna and that he was just like a mouthpiece. And there was one occasion when I was with him when he expressed that again. That was on September the 4th, 1976. And Prabhupada was in Vrindavan. So we were just relaxing in Prabhupada's room, and Prabhupada was discussing this verse from the Srimad Bhagavatam that describes the qualities of a sadhu, Canto 3, chapter 25, verse 21. So Prabhupada had Harikesh read out the verse to him. Titikshava karunika surida savadayana ajata shatrava santa sadhava sadhu bhushana. The symptoms of a sadhu are that he is tolerant, merciful, and friendly to all living entities. He has no enemies. He is peaceful, and he abides by the scriptures, and all of his characteristics are sublime. Prabhupada smiled in satisfaction. This is sadhu, he said, not the dress. Then he had Harikesh read out his lengthy purport. So, the description of the sadhu is there, Prabhupada said at the end of it. It is very nice. Where will they find this description all over the world? Complimenting Prabhupada, Harikesh said, I think there's only one person who's following that description. But Prabhupada had a different mood. He humbly appreciated the words of the Shastra. Now, I say about the Bhagavad's description, how perfect it is in every respect, in every subject matter. And he provided a revealing insight into the source of his own words in the purport. I've tried to explain what is there in the Bhagavatam. Expand it. That is not my explanation. That is Krishna's explanation. I cannot explain it now. At that moment, I could explain. That means Krishna's. I can understand that. that the description is very nicely given. Although it is my writing, but I know it is not my writing. It is Krishna's writing. So we should read the Bhagavatam always. Nityam Bhagavata Sevaya. We should not waste our time. This is not the first time that Prabhupada has said that when he writes, he is simply acting as a mouthpiece for Krishna. His words and humility today merely emphasized his role as the transparent via media between us and Krishna, and it gave us another glimpse into the intimacy of his relationship with the Lord. So that was a direct statement that we got from Prabhupada, that when he sits and writes, he said, I could write that purport explaining that verse at that moment. Now I couldn't do it. So that means when he sits down, then immediately says it's Krishna writing through him, that's all. So a little bit more about Prabhupada's writing then. It was still centered around the early 1960s there. He had begun the Bhagavatam writing. So April 22nd in 1976, we were in Melbourne. And Prabhupada was waiting to see some guests. So before they arrived, myself and Pushtakrishna Swami, who was his secretary at that time, were talking with him. So these informal conversations are always extremely sweet, and they give us the opportunity to ask specific questions and also to sometimes find out more details about Srila Prabhupada's past activities. Pushtakrishna Maharaj asked if many people had come to hear from him before his coming to the West. People were coming, Prabhupada said, but he had no time to visit many places or people because he was busy with his writing. To me, it seemed very significant that Prabhupada had reversed the usual trend. Generally, someone retires and dedicates their remaining days to writing. But Prabhupada wrote and then came out to teach his writings by practical example. Pushtakrishna added that he didn't think that Krishna consciousness would have had much effect upon people without Srila Prabhupada's personal example. And Prabhupada modestly agreed. That was the example of Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, he said, to teach by personal example. So, as he said there, that he was spending most of his time writing. He was doing some preaching, but mostly he was writing. And we actually, 2 months later when we were in New York, we got a very direct confirmation of that again. Not that we doubted Prabhupada, but it was nice to get more details on these kinds of things. So on July the 11th in 1976, Prabhupada had arrived in New York. He stayed there for about 10 days. He had come for the Rath Yatra, the first New York Rath Yatra. So 1966, 1976. So after 10 years, finally, the devotees had this Rath Yatra in New York where Prabhupada had first started. Anyway, so he got this letter on the 11th of July from Yasamati Nandana Prabhu from Gujarat. Prabhupada had been there the last week of December in 1975. He'd gone up to Ahmedabad, and then we had a 5-day Pandal program in a town called Sanand, which is about an hour outside of Ahmedabad. And on the last day, before we flew back to Bombay, Yaso had taken Prabhupada into Ahmedabad and showed him some buildings that he was thinking of perhaps renting, so that he could begin our ISKCON center there. So it was just beginning at that point. So Yasamati Nandan Prabhu wrote describing a highly successful Rath Yatra in Ahmedabad. The local temples had organized it, not ISKCON, but you know, just the general temples. And the Mahant of the Jagannath temple had presided over it. The devotees had a kirtan on the back of a truck during the parade, which the whole city populace witnessed. By simply leaning over the truck's side, they had sold 1,500 of the newly printed Gujarati magazine, Bhagavat Darshan, without even getting off the truck. However, because they aimed at making sure that everybody got one, they charged only 1 rupee apiece, and thus they only made 20 paise of profit on each magazine. Yasamadi Nandan's description of how they got to participate was interesting. It was by your direct mercy that we got a place on the truck, because when we met the Mahant of the Jagannath temple, he refused to see us because he thought that we were hippies. Then there was another sadhu there. And he knew your divine grace very well. So he said, you were disciples of Bhaktivedanta Swami? We said, yes. So then he went to the Mahant and he introduced us. Then the Mahant said, okay, so they can come on Tuesday and join in the temple truck with a few other sadhus of their own. And that's how we got in. So this sadhu's name was Narayan Das, and he is a Mahant of the Nilkant Mahadev Ranji Mandir in Vadigam. He said that your divine grace had stayed with him for almost 6 months in his ashram 15 or 20 years ago. He was nice, and he said that Swamiji was a great scholar and was giving lectures in the ashram every day. All day he was writing on the Bhagavatam, and he was eating only once, and in the evening just taking milk. So that was all I ever heard about this man, but he said Prabhupada had come to stay in his ashram for at least a few months, and he was spending most of his time writing. So that was a nice confirmation of what Prabhupada had told us 2 months before. So it seems that during that period anyway, Prabhupada was writing very intensively, you know, from 1960 onwards up until he left for the West. Of course, as soon as he started ISKCON, then things changed quite dramatically. He was definitely writing a lot, you know, the first year from 1965 when he arrived, September, up until about the middle of 1966. But then he got 26 Second Avenue, and as soon as he started preaching, then immediately all these young men started coming. Not only started coming and hearing from him, but then they actually wanted to take up Krishna consciousness. So then Prabhupada had to deal with that. So he let them stay in the storefront. But then just having a bunch of, you know, hippies and beatniks staying in the storefront, what was he going to do with them? So he had to think about how to engage them. So in this way, you know, ISKCON began to expand. And so Prabhupada's time and energy and, you know, mental energy, it was all becoming absorbed in dealing with the results of his preaching. So as everything expanded, then Prabhupada's time for writing got shorter and shorter and shorter. So I don't know exactly at what point Prabhupada, you know, got into the rhythm that he was in when I joined his party. I came on the party at the end of 75, and he had a very well established routine by that time, and I'm not exactly sure when that occurred, that he got into that. But certainly, once he started traveling, and you know, he expanded to San Francisco in 1967, then they opened Montreal, and then gradually like that, more and more temples. And Prabhupada said that the movement actually began really substantially from 1968 onwards. Up until that point, it was a little loose, but from 68 onwards, he started getting a lot of people joining and a lot of temples started opening, and Prabhupada started to formulate, you know, what we call our morning program, people getting up for Mangal Arati, and he started training people in deity worship. So all these different aspects of Krishna consciousness, 2 hours for chanting, 2 hours for hearing, and going out in Sankirtan, getting the devotees to go out every day chanting, and then beginning to distribute his books as the BBT was organized. I mean, Prabhupada was doing a tremendous amount of activity. It's unbelievable how one person could have done so much. And at the same time, he had to continue writing his books. You know, he came with the first canto. Then he had manuscripts for the second, and he had to get all of that edited. And he continued with his new writing. Not only that, in 67, 68, 69, he wrote the Krishna book, a summarized study of the 10th canto. He wrote the Nectar of Devotion. He wrote the teachings of Lord Chaitanya. And he was still doing the Bhagavatam as well as that. So it's just an amazing amount of work that he was doing. So how did he do that? So, of course, when I moved into Prabhupada's quarters, I saw, you know, this well-established routine that he had, as I said, by 75. So this is on December the 5th, 1975. I'd been with him about a week at that point. So the evening massage took more than a half an hour. Lately, the weather has been cold throughout the night until sunrise. Thus, Prabhupada's circulation and joints need more attention. So I took rest about 11 o'clock. As we disciples slept, Prabhupada arose around 11:30 or midnight to begin his most important work of the day, translation of the Bhagavatam and the writing of his transcendental purports. Harikesh is a light sleeper, and he often awakens as Prabhupada comes through the servants' room on his way into the darshan room. Rolling over in his sleeping bag, he offers his obeisances as Srila Prabhupada goes past. So sometimes that you're in a situation Prabhupada would come out. I remember when we were in Los Angeles and the servants' room had been actually transformed into a temporary kitchen. So I couldn't stay in there. So I was keeping my clothes, my suitcase in the broom cupboard, and I was sleeping on the veranda. Not veranda, you know, like the walkway outside leading from Prabhupada's bathroom into his sitting room. So, you know, there's a walkway there. So I was sleeping on that. So Prabhupada would come out in the nighttime sometimes to use the bathroom. So he would go past me. So sometimes I would hear him coming out and I'd roll over and, you know, offer my obeisances. Well, you're still in your sleeping bag. Just, and Prabhupada would say, no, no, it's all right. You sleep. But of course, if you heard Prabhupada coming, there's no question of not offering your obeisances. Anyway, so Harikesh, same thing when we were in Vrindavan. So sitting at his desk, Prabhupada chanted japa for an hour or so in complete concentration on the holy names. He prayed to Krishna for the ability to serve him nicely and to present the eternal words of the Srimad Bhagavatam in a manner just suitable for the understanding of the entire world, conscious that his work will form the basis for law and order in the next 10,000 years. Putting aside his japa mala, he donned his spectacles and clicked on the desk light. He opened the Bhagavatams at the bookmarks, the green Varanasi edition with the Sanskrit commentaries of previous acharyas, and the red Bengali one with commentaries by Srila Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur. He leaned forward and studied them intently. The microphone close to his mouth, he flicked on the tape and began his dictation. Srimad Bhagavatam, 7th canto, 7th chapter, verse 25, purport continued. Actually, when I was looking into this, I found out I could see which verses Prabhupada was translating on the different nights. So that he actually, that it was that particular night when he did that purport. But that was a composite. That was taken from, you know, things that Prabhupada had said and that we knew about him when he was doing his evening translation work. So I kind of put a composite picture there just as an example of what was happening every evening. Anyway, so there was a confirmation of this, how he was writing in the night time. When we went to Toronto, this was in June of 76, and on the 18th, Prabhupada had a visit from several professors. One of them was Joseph O'Connell. He was, I think he taught, was teaching philosophy or something at the University of Toronto. He had met Prabhupada one time before. He was a fairly young guy, actually, maybe about 40 at the time. And he appreciated Prabhupada. He had suggested also that Prabhupada, why not send your disciples to take our philosophy courses at the university? And afterwards, Prabhupada commented, he said, that means that they're going out of business. He said, now nobody wants philosophy courses. Yeah, they all want technology. He said, therefore, he's soliciting, oh, send your disciples so we can keep in our jobs. Anyway, so always conscious of his mission and aware of the slightest opportunity for preaching, Prabhupada suggested to the professors that they consider his books for texts in their classes, citing the recent orders that he has received from East Germany. So they asked, you know, why don't you send your students? So then he asked, why don't you put my books in your courses? And there was actually some good news that we'd gotten from Ghanashyam Das, who later became Bhakti Tirtha Swami. He was on his own in East Germany, at that time, communist East Germany, selling Prabhupada's books in the universities and getting standing orders from the libraries and universities then. Prabhupada was very, very pleased with that. So one of the professors asked him how long it had taken to complete the Chaitanya Charitamrita, especially wondering when he found time to write. So the Chaitanya Charitamrita had just come out the year before, in 1975, and it was kind of like a sensation amongst the academic circles. And Prabhupada explained that it took him a year and a half to complete the 17 volumes, and he explained his schedule. I write in the night. I go to bed at 10:30. I get up at 12:30. Then I finish my chanting, if there is any balance. And then I begin dictating. And in the morning, they take it and they type it. So this dictaphone is always with me, wherever I go, so that my writing is not stopped. Maybe few pages, but something is there daily. Little drops of water, where's the stone? So in that way, we've translated so many books. About 54 books are already published, besides the small booklets. And we've published Bhagavatam, 22 volumes. So I'm expecting 60 volumes. 60 volumes of 400 pages. So the biggest canto is the 10th canto. I have already published the 10th canto, summarized Krishna. But in detail, it will take at least 20 volumes. The 10th is almost as big as the rest of the book, his guest observed. Prabhupada smiled. There are 90 chapters. All the other cantos, at most 30 chapters, but the 10th canto is 90 chapters. That is Krishna's face, Krishna's beautiful face. Everyone is attracted by the smiling face of Krishna. So, that, you know, in a year and a half, Prabhupada did the entire Chaitanya Charitamrita and was still producing the Bhagavatam at the same time. And there's an amusing story connected with that, because when Prabhupada first brought out his Bhagavad Gita, they wanted to get some endorsements. You know, Macmillan had published, I think it was Macmillan, or Penguin had published it. And so they were trying to get some, you know, favorable reviews to help the sales. So in the front of the original Gita, there's one, I think it was a foreword or something, from a Professor Dimmock. Dimmock at that time was considered one of the leading academic authorities, you know, on Eastern religions and especially Sanskrit and things like this. So he was not actually very favorable to the devotees. He wasn't very favorable even to Srila Prabhupada. But the way that they got this review was that he was a well-known drunkard. Yeah. So they had originally, you know, asked him to write something, but what he wrote, it was not possible to publish it. So the devotees wrote the review. Then they went there and they waited until they saw he was drunk. And then they gave him it to sign, so he signed it without really reading it. And then they printed that. So, anyway, Dimmock, his life's opus was going to be the first English translation of the Chaitanya Charitamrita. So he was working on that. And I think maybe at that time he may have had something like one volume that was ready for publication. So then Srila Prabhupada in 1.5 years does the whole thing, publishes it in 17 volumes with so many colored, you know, photographs, pictures and photographs also in many of the places, etc., etc. So then the devotees actually went round to Dimmock, the library party devotees. They took the whole set and they said when they showed Dimmock Prabhupada's Chaitanya Charitamrita, they said he practically had a heart attack. It was like his whole life's ambition was gone and it just, you know, vanished in smoke because Prabhupada had beaten him to it. So anyway, that was Prabhupada's, you know, production capacity. It was just amazing. And it was appreciated by many, many different people. So these professors, they specifically asked, you know, how did you find the time to do this Chaitanya Charitamrita? It stunned them. It just, you know, one year there was nothing. The next year, there it is, 17 volumes. So similarly, just as the professors appreciated, then also the laymen appreciated. One of those was George Harrison. So the following month, we came to England, and on the 26th of July, George came at Prabhupada's invitation to see him. Because at that time, Prabhupada was very sick. He had left New York with a very heavy cold, almost like a flu. And if you have a heavy cold, you're advised not to fly, because it causes a lot of problems, you know, with the pressure and all that kind of stuff. But Prabhupada said, no, the devotees have made progress, so I have to go. So on the way over, night flight, he got really, really sick. And he spent the whole flight just lying down and just puffing up all this thick, heavy mucus every few minutes. And he was so sick, actually, that when we arrived in London, he actually asked Gurudas Maharaj to get him a wheelchair. I mean, for Prabhupada to ask for that meant that, I mean, that was really serious. Because Prabhupada was a very kind of self-sufficient person. You know, if something wasn't there, he didn't mind. He would just go right ahead and do it. And although he took service from us, that was for our benefit. It wasn't for his benefit. He would have been perfectly happy to do the whole thing himself. So that to ask for a wheelchair meant it was really serious. As it was, the wheelchair was not immediately available. Prabhupada didn't want to wait on the airplane. So he just stood up and got off, and he started walking down, you know, the long, long corridors of Heathrow Airport. So we'd gotten about maybe 50 or 100 meters from the airplane. Gurudas came running up, panting. And he said, I managed to, you know, arrange for this wheelchair, but they'll only give it at the aircraft entrance. So we have to go back to the aircraft, and then they'll... It's some weird rule. I don't know what they were thinking of. And Prabhupada just shook his head and kept on walking. And as he was walking, he was swaying. He was so dizzy, you know, from all the mucus in his system and the pressurized, you know, the decompressurized. So he was literally swaying from side to side. And he would stop every 50 meters or so just to steady himself. So I was there just, you know, right by him, just in case anything happened. And the airport authorities apparently had been tipped off that was a potential problem. So they sent two policemen, and they kind of fell into line about 10 meters behind us, and they just kept this discreet distance all the way up to the immigration counter. And then when we got to the immigration, rather than have Prabhupada go up and, you know, stand there whilst they looked at his visa and everything, we had him sit down, and then I went up with Prabhupada's passport in my arm, because I had a British passport, so it was not a problem. But with Prabhupada, he had a very thick, like a double passport, because his old passport was used up, and then they'd stapled on a new one. But the visa wasn't in, his visa for England wasn't in the new section, it was in the old one. So I gave the passport, and I told the, you know, the young man that was behind the counter, the visa's in the front section. So he deliberately turned the thing face down and then started leafing through from the back section, one page at a time, really slowly. And I got so frustrated, I snatched it off him and I opened it up at the visa and I said, it's there, because I wanted Prabhupada to just get through. And this this character was so crazy. He grabbed his rubber stamp and he thrust it at me. He said, "Here, why do you stamp it too? Go on, why do you stamp it like this?" I was thinking, what if this man's a crazy, you know? He's a young guy, he's a big ego, you know, he was trying to show me who was boss. And then I saw the cops looking at him, and he saw them looking at him, and then he kind of cooled down. And, you know, so he puts the stamp on. And then as he's giving it back to me, he says, "Here, ain't he the bloke that wrote the Bhagavad Gita?" I was amazed that, you know, that he even knew what the Bhagavad Gita was, what to speak, that Prabhupada had written it. So I, you know, I kind of softened. I said, "Well, how did you know that?" He said, "I got one on Oxford Street." So I said, "Okay, well," I said, "yeah, you know, Prabhupada's going to be here for a few days. We have our place at Lashmore Heath. So he's going to be speaking on the Gita, so why don't you come out and see him? So, all right. Off we went. Anyway, Prabhupada came through, and I think they were having a reception, but we cancelled that, and we got straight in the car and drove to the manor, and we had to stop twice on the way to the manor. Prabhupada was throwing up. So it was very, very difficult. And as soon as we arrived at the manor, then Prabhupada went straight up to his rooms. And he virtually spent the first couple of days in bed. He was just too sick to do anything. It's like a heavy flu that he'd gotten. So he was still sick when George came on the 26th. But he'd been at least greeting, he'd greeted the deities that morning. And George was due sometime in the afternoon. Gurudas and Mukunda had gone to bring him. So Prabhupada told me, he said, now he was in bed, and he said, when George comes, you wake me up. And we had a standing rule that if Prabhupada's asleep, nobody wakes him up for anything. It doesn't matter who they are. Even if, you know, it was the Queen of England walking in, we wouldn't have woken him up. She would have been told to wait. But Prabhupada said, if George comes, you wake me up. So when George arrived, I think it was probably about 2 in the afternoon. And so I went in and, you know, woke Srila Prabhupada and said, George is here. And I expected that he was going to get up and go into the darshan room. But Prabhupada just sat up in the bed and he said, all right, bring him in. So he gave George this darshan in his bedroom. He was sitting in bed. And George came in and then he had him sit down and he had his... The devotees had cooked a nice feast for him. So Prabhupada had them bring all the pots into his bedroom. And he had the chunkies there, and everybody sat down, and then he started feeding them. And as George was eating, then Prabhupada was chatting to him. So it was nice. Mukunda was there, and Gurudas, and I don't know who else. A few others, anyway. Jaitirtha was there, a few of the other leaders. So they were all eating, and then Prabhupada was chanting to George. So Prabhupada asked George if he was reading his books at all. George said that he was, mainly the Krishna book. Mukunda gave me the new books, he said, but there's so much, there's just so much to read. I don't know how anybody could have written it. It's difficult enough to read all of that amount. Prabhupada acknowledged his appreciation. Sometimes they are surprised how one man can write so many books, but it is Krishna's grace, he said humbly. Otherwise, not possible. For a human being, it is not possible. Ranshaw, then later on there was some, Prabhupada quoted a few verses, so it kind of caught George's attention. So as Ranshaw was looking at one of the verses, George expressed his respect for Srila Prabhupada's hard labor. These books are such a lot of work, he said. I don't know how he could do it all. Gurudas explained that Prabhupada translated at night, and Prabhupada added, at night I don't sleep. Not that because I am nowadays sick, but generally I don't sleep. At most 2 hours. I take a little rest during the daytime. So on the whole, 3 or 4 hours. But actually, I do not like to sleep. And George empathized. No, it's a waste of time. And Prabhupada said, I think it is. When I go to sleep, I think that now I'm going to waste my time. I actually think like that. What's the word for it? George said. They call it little death. Sleep is a little death. Prabhupada quoted Prahlad Maharaj's instructions on the 7th canto, part 2. He is estimating that you have got 100 years at most. So out of that, 50 years lost sleep, and then 20 years playing as a child, as a boy. So then he had me read out the verses that describe how a materially attached person wastes an entire life of 100 years. George showed some interest in those verses, and so Prabhupada gave him that volume too. He'd given him a volume with a new one. Now he gave him that one. So George was appreciating how one man can write so much, and Prabhupada said yes. For a human being, is not possible. Then, again, comments that Prabhupada made to me also. When 2 months previously, when we had been in Hawaii, actually Prabhupada had gone to Hawaii for the whole month, because in April, we'd been in Vrindavan at the last leg of the Gaupunima festival, and Rameshwara Swami had come to see Srila Prabhupada. He was the head of the BBT. And he informed Prabhupada that now we've practically caught up with you. Because the year before, Prabhupada had gone to Los Angeles. This was, I think, in about April of 75. I wasn't on the party at that time. I think Shridakirti was. But Prabhupada had gone to Los Angeles, and he had been informed that, you know, there were like 17 volumes of the Bhagavatam that was still in production. But nothing was coming, you know, it was coming out very, very slowly. So there was this huge backlog. And Prabhupada complained that if you don't publish at the same pace that I'm writing, I'm not feeling encouraged to write. If I'm just writing and then you're just storing it up and not, you know, not publishing it. So he told them, he said, now I'm here for 2 months. He said, I want every book published within the next 2 months. So then they were on a morning walk, and Rameshwaran and Radha Balaba, who was the production manager for the BBT, they said, but Prabhupada, that's impossible. Prabhupada just said, impossible is a word in the fool's dictionary. And he just walked on. So to their credit, they left the morning walk at that moment. They didn't even wait until they got back. They immediately left. They went back to the LA temple. They called a meeting of all the BBT devotees, the artists, the editors, the Sanskrit men, the layout people, compositors, everything. And they said, okay, this is it. We're going on a 24-hour schedule. Yeah, we're going to work day and night until we get these books out for Prabhupada. So they did. They went on this marathon for 2 months, and they were working literally 24 hours a day. They had 5 or 6 artists working on the same painting. Instead of one man doing the whole thing, whoever was good at trees or backgrounds or figures or hands or feet or whatever it was, then you know, they'd do their little bit and somebody else would come in and then do their bit. So it's like a whole production line of paintings. That was when all the rest of the Chaitanya Charitamritas came out. So they got all of that out, and then they also, I think, got several volumes of the Bhagavatam out as well. So at the end of June of 75, they'd done it. They actually produced like 17 volumes. They got them all out. Prabhupada was very pleased. Anyway, so there was still some backlog, a few volumes, and by early 76, they'd caught up. So Rameshwara went to see Prabhupada in Vrindavan, and he told him, Srila Prabhupada, now we've practically caught you up. So now we want you to, you know, do more writing. So he said, on your way to America, you know, please stay in Hawaii, and it would be nice if you can stay there for a month because it's quiet, nobody's coming there, you know, you won't be bothered or distracted by any managerial things, and you can do more writing. So Prabhupada said, yes, very good. So that's exactly what he did. He went there at the beginning of May from Fiji, and he stayed until the end of that month. And he actually increased his writing phenomenally. Some nights he was doing 6 or 7 times the amount of writing that he was normally doing. So on May the 10th, 1976, it was Ekadasi. So before going out for his morning walk, Prabhupada summoned me with the buzzer. Going into his room, I offered my obeisances and knelt before him, eager to execute his bidding. He asked if we had the Sanskrit edition of the Srimad Bhagavatam 8th canto with us. He said that he would finish the 7th canto by that evening. So this was very heartening to hear. So I was excited, and I expressed my pleasure at this welcome news. Prabhupada remained modest and sober. With a slight smile and an unassuming tip of his head, he told me, oh, I can finish it very quickly, but I have to present it for your understanding. It requires deep thought, very carefully, for the common man. So then in the evening, at 9:15, Prabhupada called me in. Expecting him to be ready to take rest in his massage, I was surprised to find him already sitting at his desk with his spectacles on, his Bhagavatam open, and his dictaphone in his hand. He told me that he would not take his massage. Rather, he said he would finish translating the 7th canto. I was surprised but elated. It's the first time that I've been with him in over 5 months now that he has missed his evening rest. He worked all through the night, and after he went for his early morning ablutions, I checked the dictaphone, and I saw that he had notched up 320 digits on the counter. Normally, he does 50 or less, so he did about 7 times the amount. He was able to get 25 verses of the 8th canto done. He is mercifully fulfilling our hope that by spending extra time here in Hawaii, away from management problems and constant streams of visitors, that he'll be able to concentrate on the essence of his preaching work. Everybody is growing very heartened to see how much extra writing he is doing since his arrival here in Honolulu. And that night, Prabhupada finished the 7th canto, and he wrote at the end of that this note. Thus ends the Bhaktivedanta purport of the 7th canto, 15th chapter of the Srimad Bhagavatam, entitled Instructions for Civilized Human Beings, completed on the night of Vaishakhi Shukla Ekadasi, 10th of May, 1976, in the temple of Panchatattva, New Navadvipa, Honolulu, by the mercy of Sri Krishna Chaitanya, Prabhu Nityananda, Sri Advaita Gadadhar, Sri Vasudhi Gaura Bhaktivrinda. Thus we may happily chant, Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare, Hare Rama, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare. So that was Prabhupada's end note. He stayed up all night doing that one. So then a couple of days later, on May the 15th, by this time, Prabhupada, because Prajumni flew in the early part of Prabhupada's Hawaii visit. He had seen Prabhupada in April in Bombay, and he had been living down south studying Sanskrit or something. So then Prabhupada had called him up and he asked him, now what are you doing? And I'm this and that. And Prabhupada said, no, you should travel with me. I need a Sanskrit editor. So then he couldn't immediately come with us when we left on the 18th of April to go to Australia. So he flew into Hawaii in May. Because when he arrived, he was really sick. He had a swelling in his hip. It looked like somebody had stuck a cricket ball or something underneath the skin. It was so swollen out. It was a boil. But it was inside, not out. And he could hardly walk. So when Prabhupada saw that, he told him he immediately go to the doctor. So the doctor had put him on these antibiotics. And then after 3 or 4 days, Prabhupada asked, where's Pradyumna? Why is he not on the morning walk? And then we said, because he can't walk. He's lying down in his room there, and he can't move because of this thing, and he's taking this medicine. So Prabhupada, when he got back, he went into his room to see, and he said, immediately, he said, you go to the doctor and tell him to lance it. So they took him off, and then he came back about 2 hours later, and he had this crater in his hip. It was like about 6 inches long, about a half an inch wide, and about a half inch deep. It was like a huge slit. And he said when they got him in there, the doctor took one look at it. He said, yeah, lie down. And then he took a scalpel out, and he slit it. And he said that the thing burst and went, it sprayed all over the room. Just all pus. So he cleaned him up and then sent him back. So Prabhupada kind of basically saved him. He would have got gangrene or something if it had lasted much, you know, waited any longer. But anyway, Pradumni was there, so he started with, you know, doing the Sanskrit. Then we had another devotee that rejoined Prabhupada, and that was Hayagriva. So Hayagriva, of course, was Prabhupada's very first editor in 26 Second Avenue. He was an English professor. And he started the first work, putting, you know, all of the manuscripts that Prabhupada had into good English. Then he had problems, and I think around about 73, he left. And he was kind of away for a couple of years. Then in 76, somehow or another, he made a comeback. So immediately the BBT said, all right, Prabhupada's in Honolulu. We'll send you there, and you can work with him to finish this, what was then called the philosophy book. So the philosophy book had been started in 1971 Shyama Sundar had been a student of philosophy. He was Prabhupada's secretary when they were in Bombay. He was the first team that went to India. And he had made a suggestion to Srila Prabhupada that it would be very good if he could give some commentary on all the Western philosophers. So Prabhupada liked that idea. So he had gotten a small book and he read up, all the summary of the philosophies of different Western philosophers. And then he was speaking with Prabhupada every day, saying what this philosopher says, Socrates or Plato or this one or that one. And then Prabhupada would give the Vedic view of that. Then somehow or another, it didn't get finished. Shyama Sundar also had problems. He left, I think in like early 74. And so this whole project got stalled. And Prabhupada was complaining about it because he really wanted it to come out and be distributed in the universities. So now Hayagriva turned up. And so he came and spent, I think, about 2.5 weeks in Hawaii. And so apart from what Prabhupada was doing, all the extra work he was doing on the Bhagavatam, in the daytime, he was also meeting with Hayagriva and spending 2 to 3 hours every afternoon with this heavy, heavy philosophical stuff, discussing all these different philosophers. And then right after that, he'd have about an hour's break, and then he'd get into doing his, his Bhagavatam. And some nights he was just staying up and not even going to sleep. So incredible workload that he was doing. So on May the 15th, despite the disruptions of the day, Prabhupada and Hayagriva discussed the philosophies of Socrates and Plato for 2.5 hours this evening. And afterwards, Prabhupada went straight into his translation work, dictating throughout the night and notching up another 315 digits on the dictaphone. So that was very encouraging. He got a huge amount of work done, finished the 7th canto, got well into the 8th canto. So an example of, as Prabhupada said, I could do it very quickly, but I have to concentrate every word. I have to think very carefully. So I had one experience of how intense his concentration was when we got to Vrindavan at the end of the year. This was in November. So on November the 8th, just after taking rest at about 11 p.m., I heard Prabhupada's buzzer ring. So rolling out of my sleeping bag, I went into Prabhupada's darshan room where he was already sitting at his desk, microphone in hand, peering over the pages of the Srimad Bhagavatam. After offering my obeisances, I sat before him, eager to know the purpose of his call. Prabhupada looked at me over his glasses, and indicating something in mid-air, he said, "There's some noise disturbing. Just stop it." So I listened, but there's only silence to my ear. Seeing my puzzled expression, Prabhupada's eyebrows raised, and his finger pointed upwards. "No, just listen." Again, I listened hard, trying to open up my ears and perceive whatever it was that was disturbing his divine grace. After a few seconds, I started to pick up on what seemed to be a very faint, distant hum. Prabhupada was observing me closely, and when he saw the dawn of recognition on my face, he confirmed my perception. "Ha! Now, go and find it and stop it." Jaya Shishi Satyanandan Nitaichan Kita. Now tuned in, I walked off towards the entrance door, following the sound which seemed to be coming from a source high up and distant. Going outside, I moved towards the temple and the sound receded. Going the other way, towards the guest house, the faint vibration began to increase. I entered the building and I started up the staircase, the humming beginning to increase in volume the higher that I climbed. Finally, I arrived at the top floor of the 4-story building, sure by this time that I had identified the cause. Going down the corridor, I banged on the door of one of the single rooms. After a minute, the door opened to reveal a sleepy, agitated Vishal Das, quite grumpy about being awakened at such a late hour. "Vishal Prabhu," I said humbly, "you've got your fan on, and it's disturbing Srila Prabhupada in his translation work." The fan was hanging from the ceiling, whirling around at full tilt, and I couldn't think why he would want to have it on in the cold of a winter night. But there was no discussion. Vishal was immediately profusely apologetic at the thought that he might be causing an inconvenience to Srila Prabhupada, and he quickly shut it off. After thanking him, I went back down to Prabhupada's quarters, and when I entered, he was already deeply absorbed, sitting by the light of his desk lamp, studying the text, and flicking on and off the switch of his dictaphone microphone as he constructed his purports. He gave me but a brief glance of acknowledgement, and I took rest, impressed by the intense concentration that he applies to his work, and grateful for the opportunity to assist him in it. So, just a fan, four floor stories up. Yeah. There was a time, actually, there was one time when Prabhupada was unable to translate because of external noise. That was when we got to Fiji, because we arrived in Fiji. In those days, Fiji, they didn't even have a TV station. The island was nice, you know, it was kind of quiet, or at least I thought it was going to be quiet. So Vasudeva put us up in his house, and then I set everything up, you know, for Prabhupada to do his dictation work in the night time. After I gave him his massage, I took rest. I came in the morning, and Prabhupada was sitting chanting his japa, and then he said I couldn't work last night. I wondered why. And then Prabhupada said that there was a constant howling of dogs all around the area, all night long. It would start in one place, and then the dogs over here would start, and then it would start the dogs over here, and then the dogs over here, and all night long, just yowling. And it was, so anyway, Prabhupada couldn't concentrate, so he didn't do any translation work practically whilst we were there in Fiji. So anyway, writing, as you can see, is a very hard work and very taxing. They say that 2 hours of mental endeavor is equivalent to 6 hours of physical endeavor. The same amount of energy is used up when you're just using your brain like that. So Prabhupada, again, he got an appreciation from another writer. This was George Orwell. Not George Orwell, the famous author, but George Orwell, who was the religious editor for Associated Press. Just had the same name. So this man came to see Srila Prabhupada on July 16th when he was in New York. And Mr. Orwell also asked Prabhupada, he had a long interview. It was a great interview. Fantastic. Prabhupada really got into a very intense discussion with him, giving these analogies about the car and the driver, and then the prisoners in the jailhouse. And he was trying to explain to this man, you know, because his question had been that, aren't you depriving the world of the, you know, the labor of these young people? They could be making a contribution to the world, but you're kind of withdrawing from it. And then Prabhupada was trying to explain, no, we're making a contribution, but it's different from the one that you're doing. So anyway, Mr. Orwell also asked Prabhupada what he thought about Judaism and Christianity. Prabhupada said that he didn't know because he hadn't studied them. But any religion, if it frees its adherents from the bodily conception of life, is first class. Mr. Orwell said that he didn't think that they did that. He thought that they considered the body important and cherished the world. Which was his point, you know, you're rejecting the world, but actually, shouldn't we really appreciate it? Prabhupada responded that such a conception was ignorance. He explained that he was attracting people from every religion and community, because real knowledge is for everyone. Just like 2 + 2 = 4 is the same for everyone, and gold is gold for everyone. So Mr. Orwell asked, who had the gold? Just the Krishna consciousness movement, or are there other paths to spiritual enlightenment? Prabhupada replied that there are other paths, but they are not very elaborate. So this prompted Mr. Orwell to ask if Krishna consciousness was elaborate. Prabhupada indicated his bookshelf. We are explaining this science in so many books. It is open to everyone. A writer himself, Mr. Orwell was very impressed with Prabhupada's output, especially when we told him another 40 volumes were yet to come. Are all of these translations that you have made, Your Grace? I don't blame you for sleeping only 4 hours a night. I tell you, just to produce a half a dozen books in a lifetime is quite a job, you know. Prabhupada admitted, it is very difficult, but I have already produced 80 books, and all world scholars, professors, universities, they are receiving so nicely. So, you know, I mean, we were young, we tended to think about what Prabhupada was doing in one way as being kind of natural. You know, it's what he did, and Prabhupada just made things seem effortless. You know, the way that he just traveled and preached and, you know, wrote his books and managed and did so many things. But, of course, after Prabhupada left and then we had to stay, you know, continue doing the same things, then we started to realize just how difficult it was. And this Mr. Orwell, he was a professional writer. He was a newspaper man. And he said, just to make a half a dozen books in a lifetime is quite a job. Prabhupada said, yes, it's very hard work. Prabhupada said it, it's very hard work, but he made it look easy. So, actually, there was one professor, I heard this several years back. He came to some scholarly convention, and some of our devotees were there. And, not exactly the context, but it came up, they were talking about, you know, Prabhupada coming out at the age of 70 and beginning the movement. So this man, he was an older professor. He said, actually, you said, you talk about that. But he said, you don't really understand it. He said, you don't really, you really don't know what it means. He said, when you get to be 70, then you'll understand what it means. Because he was of himself. He said, I'm over 70 now. He said, and I can tell you, it's an absolutely unbelievable thing that Prabhupada did. So. Anyway, so then, again, Prabhupada was discussing his books. This was with Rameshwara, when we got to Los Angeles, of course. Wherever there is Srila Prabhupada and Rameshwara Swami, there must also be talk about books. Rameshwara praised Srila Prabhupada for his prolific literary output. People are surprised that you have written so many books. They cannot understand how you could write so much. They wonder whether you were a very great Sanskrit scholar for many years, and they try to guess. They just can't imagine anybody writing so much. Prabhupada modestly acknowledged the compliment. We are exceeding all material authors, except Vyasadeva. One book, 17 volumes, Chaitanya Charitamrita. So, then also, so many our godbrothers, they have attempted. Have any of your godbrothers translated anything? I asked. Prabhupada shook his head. They died halfway finished. He said somewhat wryly. Rameshwara said, they wonder where you had the time to study so much about ancient Indian culture that you could write so much. They cannot understand that. There's a biography of your divine grace in the Bhagavatam that mentions different things, and they just can't understand how you could know so much. It is beyond material conception. So Prabhupada smilingly narrated an incident that he's fond of recalling. One young man in Tokyo or some airport, a very nice young man, so he came. I was sitting. Swamiji, can I talk with you? Yes. So I have seen your photograph. Where have you got so much vast knowledge? And I said, it is not my knowledge. It is Vyasadeva's knowledge. So this was his first question was this. Intelligent boy. So he asked him, where have you got such vast knowledge? And later on we were in Tehran. We went there in August of 76. Because in those days the Shah of Iran was still in charge. And you actually were able to go in and out of the country, Westerners. And there were about 6 householders there. Atreya Rishi and his wife, he was a GBC, and an old friend of his, Navayovana, and his wife, they just had a son. and Dayananda and his wife, Nandarani. And then there was one sannyasi, Paribrajakacharya. Paribrajakacharya, actually, he was doing amazing preaching at that time. He'd been a yoga teacher, Hatha yoga teacher, before he became a devotee. And when he went to Iran, he'd started, you know, teaching Hatha yoga as a means to kind of surreptitiously introduce people to Krishna consciousness. But one of his early customers happened to be, I think, like a nephew of the Shah. And he had drug problems and he was trying to, you know, kind of fix himself up. So he was learning yoga. So he was so impressed, then he told the niece of the Shah. And she came and she started learning. So she was having Paribrajakacharya come to the palace and go into the inner courtyard or area of the palace where nobody is allowed. No men had ever been in there before. And certainly no Westerners had ever set foot in the palace. And Paribrajakacharya is going in there and teaching them yoga every, you know, like a few times a week. So it's amazing stuff going on. Anyway, so Prabhupada was giving short classes there, but he'd just gone there to encourage the devotees, actually, these three householder couples. And so he told us that although in the spiritual world, we do not have to work to maintain our existence, here in the material world, we do, and yet we still have to become Krishna conscious. His words were pertinent because as soon as he finished his lecture, Atreya Rishi, Dayananda, and the others would be going out to engage in seemingly mundane jobs. That was how they were maintaining themselves. They were working in the day, and in the night time they were preaching, and at the weekends. So Prabhupada cited another example to encourage them that what they are doing is actually spiritual. He said, because a devotee has nothing to do with material things. Even if he works for the maintenance of the body, that is not material. Just like Bhaktivinoda Thakur, who was a magistrate. It is not for a magistrate to write so many books, Siddhanta Purnam. So he was in a different, transcendental platform. So that is possible. The mind may be absorbed in Krishna's thought. Satatam kirti yanto man tushyanti cham ramanti cham. So that is possible by practice. So again, another example of Bhaktivinoda Thakur writing so many books, even though he was doing so many other things at the same time. And in this biography, the seventh Goswami, written by one of my godbrothers, Rupa Vilas, it's mentioned there that Bhaktivinoda Thakur, in his autobiography, he said that when he was writing all these books, he was writing so much that he was getting intense headaches and fever sometimes from the effort that it was taking him to do the writing. But still he was writing even despite that. So it's our tradition, you know, to work very hard. And Prabhupada said that publishing is our family business. Yeah, writing and publishing is our family business. Right from the six Goswamis onwards. So again, another appreciation came from another reporter. This was actually a junior reporter that had been sent by Newsweek magazine. You know, Rameshwar had hired a professional publicist to try to get some good interviews for Srila Prabhupada whilst he was in America. Nitai Chan Ki then. So, you know, they got an interview with Newsweek magazine. Big thing. But then, as it turned out, they sent a junior girl reporter, and Prabhupada was less than impressed. So when she came, practically refused to speak to her. Because as she was coming up, he said, she'll come and then she'll just ask, how many people have you got? How many temples have you got? How much money are you making? Like this. And in fact, that's exactly how she started off. So Prabhupada, she asked him some questions, and Prabhupada said, why? Why should I tell you? So she never interviewed somebody before that refused to tell her anything. So anyway, so it got to the point where the interview was kind of breaking down a little bit. So then Rameshwara said, why don't you ask Prabhupada about his books? So the mention of his books gave Srila Prabhupada the opportunity to guide the interview in the direction that he wanted it to go. So he began to open up a little. He told Wanda that if she really wanted to understand something about him, then she should read his books, because a man is known by what he speaks. Tavachcha sobatay muko yava kinchin navasate. A fool is so long beautiful as long as he does not speak. When he speaks, then you can understand what he is. So my speaking are there in these books. And if you are intelligent, then you can understand. You haven't got to ask. Just like in court, a big lawyer, he is known when he speaks. Otherwise, everybody is a good lawyer. But when he speaks in the court, then it is known whether he is a good lawyer or not. So you have to hear, and you have to read, and then you'll understand. Real understanding is there. So, Prabhupada said, if you want to know me, you just read my books. That's all. Living back in time. Is there a glass of water somewhere? Any questions up to this point? Writing means communication. There are some of Prabhupada's dictations that are still available. Generally speaking, the tapes were wiped off and then reused. Prabhupada was very frugal. He didn't like to just spend money unnecessarily. As soon as they transcribed the tape, they immediately erased it, sent it back to Prabhupada, and he would reuse it again. But some tapes were actually kept. And I think you can get the dictation of the introduction to the Bhagavad Gita. They still have that. And like the whole of the Krishna book, that's available also. But mostly, you know, all of Prabhupada's Bhagavatam stuff, that was all just wiped off. Same thing. Whether what's in your heart comes through your hand in a pen, or whether it comes out your mouth into a dictaphone, it's the same process. Now, Prabhupada didn't need to draft anything out. Yeah, it came out. That was it. Yes. Some of the original manuscripts are still there in the archives. Some of them have been lost. Like the Bhagavad Gita. When Jagvaita Maharaj undertook a revision of the Bhagavad Gita to correct some glaring mistakes in there, they found the first six chapters. We have the original type manuscript directly from Prabhupada. The second six chapters, they had the first editor's version, the first edited version. And the last six chapters, nothing was available. So, what happened to the original manuscripts, I don't know. Some of them got lost and misplaced here and there. But, of course, by that time, they were already in print anyway, so we have that. Yes. Well, when I was with Prabhupada, as I mentioned, you know, the BBT was keeping pace with him. They were publishing at the same rate that he was producing, he was speaking. So what Prabhupada did in the night time, the very next morning, that was transcribed. Now, when I first joined the party, Hari Kesh was doing that. When he left the party, Pushpa Krishna came on, and for 4 months he was doing that. Then Pradyumna's wife, Arundhati, she joined the party. So Pradyumna was doing the Sanskrit editing. And he would go to see Prabhupada, you know, every day or every few days and get all the corrections and confer with him if he had to make any changes. And his wife, Arundhati was a very expert typist, and she was trained, you know, in how to transcribe Prabhupada's tapes. Now, I had a very brief experience of doing transcription, because when we went from Delhi to Hyderabad in late 1976, Pradyumna and his wife, Arundhati, they had to stay in Delhi because they had a problem with their visa. But the work had to go on, and we weren't expecting them for, you know, maybe a week or so. So when we arrived in Hyderabad, then Prabhupada told Jagadish, who was his secretary by that time, you do it. So Jagadish had never done it before. When he started trying to do the transcriptions, a lot of this, you know, the dictations, he couldn't understand what was being said. Prabhupada had this style of translating. He would start to speak, then he would flick on the microphone. It had an on-off button, and sometimes, you know, he would reverse it as well. So he would flick on, and as he's flicking on the microphone, he would start speaking. So, you know, like half the first word, or even the first word, would be missing off the tape because it, you know, it was a little slower. And he would often switch the microphone on and off in mid-sentence. You know, instead of speaking like a whole sentence and then stop, he would flick it on and off as he was speaking. Kind of compose a few words and then a few more and a few more and make a sentence like that. So it was not an easy job, and you really have to be tuned in to Prabhupada's style in order to be able to figure out what he was saying. So Jagadish had a go, and he just couldn't figure it out. He told me, you have a listen. So I was listening as well, and I think in about 2 hours or something, we managed to get 2 or 3 sentences. And it was just really difficult. And I was just, you know, as I say, I was listening to Prabhupada 5 or 6 hours a day speaking, so I knew very well his accent. But it was just very difficult hearing these tapes. But then Arundhati turned up the next day that, you know, somehow or another, the visa problem wasn't as bad as they thought. So they just got the next train down. She sat down, and in 1 hour, she completely finished everything. We couldn't get done in here, like a pain in the ass, but just because she knew it. So there were some people, you know, that were quite expert at those things. They'd been trained at the DBT. Yeah. Yes. The Bhagavad Gita, I'm not sure which edition he was using, you know, to make his translations and then add his purports to. I mean, the Bhagavad Gita it's a standard text, and the Sanskrit remains the same no matter who's translating it. So, maybe he got it from the Gita Press or something like that. These Bhagavatams that he was working from, the Sanskrit Bhagavatam that he had was, I think that was put out by Gita Press. And that had commentaries from about 14 different previous acharyas. Somebody compiled them all together and put them all in one edition. So, you know, you can see where Prabhupada says in this connection, this connection. Says, or Jiva Goswami says this. All of those tikkas or commentaries were all in one volume. And so Prabhupada would translate the Sanskrit verse, then he would read the purports of the tikkas of the previous acharyas. He would pick out the relevant points that he wanted to make, and then he would add in his own points and his own realizations, and that was how he made his purports. So he had, when we traveled, we had this Varanasi edition. And then there was also the translation and commentary of the Bhagavatam Vaishnava Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati, which was in Bengali. So but he had the Sanskrit, and he had the Bengali one as well, and he was
three thoughts, and then he would make his three thoughts. Yes.
Stood up the point. Well, I have, yes, you're asking were there times when Prabhupada got angry? There were indeed, yes. Sometimes he would get angry with the Mayavadis, and sometimes he would get angry with his foolish servants. And I had a few experiences of that. I don't know if we've got the time now to tell them all, but in the fifth my diary, which I've just published, there's one incident that happened there that I related, which was I'd just been with Prabhupada about a year at that time, and I won't give all the details now, but in brief, what happened was that just out of dullness and stupidity, I locked Srila Prabhupada on the roof of his Vrindavan quarters. He had gone up to take rest, you know, as he did do for an hour after breakfast. And he had, you know, there was a small veranda at the front, there was a room, and then there was a back veranda. So you had to go through the room, like two doors, one on either side. And then we would put a mattress out on the back veranda, and Prabhupada lay down in the sunshine. So this is November, so it's getting a little cool in Vrindavan, and it was just very nice in the day. So I left Prabhupada lying on the mattress, and then I went back through the room, and I decided I won't stay upstairs, as I normally did. I'll go downstairs, because I wanted to go and talk. You know, a couple of friends had arrived from Australia, and I wanted to go and, you know, have a bit of a japa with them. So I just, without thinking, I walked back through the room, closed the door behind me, and, you know, Prabhupada had trained us. You go out of a room, you switch off the lights, you switch off the fan, and you close the door. So I closed the screen door and bolted it from the inside. And I just wasn't thinking. And at the same time, I was thinking, now, Prabhupada wants me. The devotees had just recently fitted a buzzer, a button, which was connected to some bells downstairs, so that if he was upstairs, he could press this button on his desk, and it would ring downstairs. So if the servants went up there, they were down, they would hear him ring, and then they could come. So I was, as I was going through, I was thinking, now, if Prabhupada wants me, he can just ring the bell, and I'll hear it, I'll be downstairs. So I shut the door, and I slid the bolt. I wasn't even conscious I was doing it. It's just, you know, habit. And then I went off downstairs. And then after like an hour and a half, I was at the veranda, front porch, at the entrance to Prabhupada's rooms. And I was talking to these, you know, devotees from Australia, and I started thinking, wow, Prabhupada's really sleeping a long time this morning. He was taking some extra rest. And I was so wrapped up in talking that I was ignoring, you know, another voice that was inside me that was saying, go upstairs, go upstairs. And, you know, how it is sometimes, you get an intuition, but you're too wrapped up in what you're doing. So I was talking and talking, and then I was starting to feel a little uneasy. But I was ignoring it. And then all of a sudden, this German devotee, Maharati, he was quite a character. Maharati had been a butcher before he joined the movement. Yeah, he told us that when he went to work every morning, before they started work, they would drink a glass of fresh, hot blood. Yeah, every morning. And butcher. He was famous in the movement, actually, because he jumped off the top of Kesigat Palace into the Jamuna. Now, if you've seen the palace there, it's high, and there's all these steps going out. He did a standing jump from the edge of the palace on the top in 1975, and he leapt out, and he landed, he just cleared the steps and landed in the Jamuna. It was a sensation all around Vrindavan. A few years back, somebody else tried that and hit the steps, and I think he killed himself. So anyway, Maharati did it. So he was a character. So he was up in the guest room, he was visiting, and he had a room which overlooked Prabhupada's back garden and the back portion of the roof there, so he could see Prabhupada sleeping. So I'm there talking, and all of a sudden Maharati comes flying around the corner from the guest house, and he's like all red and panic stricken. So, Harry, sorry. I knew what it was as soon as he came around the corner. He said, Prabhupada's locked on the roof. So you've got to come and get him out immediately. And I, you know, it all came to me in a flash, what I'd done. And I ran through the rooms, I ran up the back stairs, I got up, I went through the room. And, you know, whenever we came into Prabhupada's presence, we always offered our obeisances. And whenever you left Prabhupada's presence, either you leave or he leaves, you offer your obeisances again. This time, I didn't even, you know, I wasn't going to waste even a half a second. Prabhupada was standing on the other side of the screen door, waiting. And I ran up, I came into the room, I saw him behind the screen there. And I ran up, Prabhupada was just looking at me. And I undid the bolt, and as I was doing that, he said, "You rascal." He said, I've been waiting here for an hour. Like this. So somehow or another he'd been trapped. And then he saw Maharati, you know, finally, after about an hour, said, "This rascal's locked me on the roof. Go and get it." So then I offered my obeisances. Prabhupada just walked straight past me and went downstairs. And I followed him into the darshan room. And, naturally I was completely mortified. And I offered my obeisances again, and I apologized. And Prabhupada looked at me and said, "You are so dull." He said, "This is from so much voracious eating and sleeping." Like that. He said, "Your brain is dull." And then he said nothing more about it. So then we went in, it was time for massage. So we went in the back garden, and I was massaging. And the whole massage, I was completely miserable. And I felt like there was this weight hanging over me, like some heavy, you know, dark weight just pressing on me. And Prabhupada was perfectly, you know, normal. It was over and done with, and that was it. Then he went in for his bath, put on his fresh cloth, had his prasada. And then he went back up on the roof again. So by that time, I figured out, you know, what to do. So we went back up on the roof. This time he sat out on the front side, and he was just sitting in the rocking chair. So as soon as Prabhupada sat down, then I offered my full length dandavats, and then as sincerely and as humbly as I could, I just said, "Prabhupada, I'm really, really sorry. It will never happen again." And then when I did that, then Prabhupada smiled and he said, "All right." And as soon as he smiled, it's like this huge weight just lifted off me. So there was, you know, it's like a reaction was there and I could feel it. And the first apology wasn't enough. I had to apologize again. And then when Prabhupada smiled and he said, "All right," then it just suddenly lifted and I felt normal again. But I actually felt like I was being crushed. And then he said, "But don't do it again." So that was like one time when he got so angry that he didn't even bother shouting at me. That was the worst. You know, there were different kinds of stages. You know, if you did something mildly wrong, sometimes Prabhupada would speak sharply at you or, you know, make some sarcastic comment, you know, just to kind of put you in your place. And if you made a really bad mistake, sometimes he would yell at you really loudly. The first time that happened to me was in Mayapur in 76 during the festival. Hari Kesh was cooking and he'd gotten really, really sick. And we fixed up a time for Prabhupada to have his lunch at 1:30. So Hari Kesh got up late one day and he was late with Prabhupada's prasadam. And I had been told by Prabhupada, go down and learn how to cook from him. So Prabhupada's quarters were on the second floor, ground first and second. And the kitchen was on the first floor. So I had to go down into the kitchen. So I'm looking at the clock and it's getting on, you know, 1:25, 1:28. Finally gets to 1:30. And I was thinking, it's the same thing again, I was thinking, now go up. I should go up and tell Prabhupada we're going to be late so that he knows. Then I was thinking, no, we're doing the cooking, it's nearly finished. Another minute, like this. So I was ignoring what was, you know, going on in my heart, which was a super soul telling me, go and see Prabhupada right now. So, you know, 1:35, 1:38, and then all of a sudden, boom, the door bangs open, and there's this devotee in Akadundavi. He was an English devotee, actually, artist. He's about 2 meters tall, big guy. Comes bursting into the kitchen. Harry, sorry. Prabhupada's been ringing the bell for 10 minutes. So again, I ran up the steps. I got into Prabhupada's room. I got halfway down, and Prabhupada yelled at me. I mean, so loudly, I froze. I didn't even get, you know, make it to the ground. So, you rascal! He chastised me like anything for about 5 minutes. He just blasted me, you know. And then when I said, well, you know, it's nearly ready, and said, I don't want your prasadam. Like this. He was yelling at me. I realized if I tried to say anything more, he was just getting more and more angry because I was defending myself. So then when I said, I hung my head, I said, I'm really sorry. Then he said, all right. He said, now whatever's there, just bring it. And by that time, Hari Kesh had actually finished it, so he got a full meal. But that was the first time that I got really blasted like that. There were a couple of other occasions. But with Prabhupada, when he got chastised like that, it was a very liberating experience. Because it was always in response to, you know, situation where your false ego was interfering with your service. You're either getting dull and being inattentive, or just somehow or another, you know, your brain wasn't working, you weren't receptive to what Prabhupada was saying or doing. Last example. This one hasn't been published yet. This will be the next volume. We were in Calcutta in 77, and we'd just come back up from Bhubaneswar. And for some reason or another, I was just kind of like in a very agitated state of mind for several days. And Akshaya, you know, he was the door guard. I was getting on his case, and one afternoon I was yelling at him out on the veranda. And it was almost something small, but I was just feeling agitated, so I blasted him. And Prabhupada had to send Gagamuni Swami out to tell me to shut up. He said, why is he yelling at him? He said he's sorry, you know. Anyway, so then in the evening, Prabhupada called me in his room. And he had a filing, like an Elmira there, and 2 or 3 shelves. And there was some cardboard files. So he said, just pass me the red file. So I looked in, and I couldn't see a red file. So I said, Prabhupada, there's no red file here. Prabhupada looked at me, he said, pass me the red file. So I looked again, and I saw there were some purple ones. And then I saw one was like a kind of a pinky purpley color. And I was thinking, well, you know, it's nearly red, but it's not really red, right? So I said, Prabhupada, there's no red file here. Prabhupada yelled at me, he said, pass me the red file! I pulled it out and I gave it to him. And he said, so, he said, you have become very expert at defending yourself. And then he blasted me for about 2 minutes. But that was his first comment. So you've become very expert at defending yourself. Because I was saying there's no red file. And he was saying, pass me the red file. Obviously, there was a red file. Otherwise, Prabhupada wouldn't have asked for it. But, you know, my ego was just kind of interfering there a little bit. And I was thinking, it's not really red, it's purple. It was, you know, I was just kind of in the modes. And Prabhupada just snapped me right out of it. I got blasted. And then he sent me out and said, call Satsarup. Or Satsarup Maharaj came in. He was visiting secretary for that month. And it had shaken me so much that as I was going out, Satsarup was coming in. He looked at me and said, what's wrong with you? I said, Prabhupada just blasted me. But then afterwards, I felt relieved. Because I knew it was just my false ego, and Prabhupada just smashed straight through it and got me back into, proper Krishna consciousness again. And, as soon as it happened, then it was over, and Prabhupada was perfectly normal. He didn't, it didn't linger on for days and weeks afterwards. It would happen and finish. That's... All right, so we should finish. It's 10:15. We'll go on tomorrow's the last day, is it tomorrow? Yeah. More things on books tomorrow evening. So if anybody's interested, we have some copies of Transcendental Diary up there, and you're quite welcome to purchase soft bands and hard bands.
Yes.
Srila Prabhupada Ki Jai.